ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit leggmason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate, Connor, and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, really excited about the show this week. As always, I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. Joining me on the podcast will be truly one of the godfathers of ETFs, Bob Toll, who is currently co-founder and president of Procure AM. They launched their first ETF earlier this year, the Procure Space ETF, which has a great ticker symbol, UFO. But Bob has literally been involved with ETFs since the beginning. He helped launch the first country-specific ETFs known as the World Equity Benchmark Series, WEBs, which, get this, these were later rebranded to none other than iShares after Barclays purchased WEBs in 1999. And altogether, Bob has been involved in the design and development of over 400 ETFs across 19 countries. So this is going to be a fun conversation because we'll talk a little ETF history and certainly touch on UFO. But given Bob's background, I thought it'd be fun to get his take on some of the biggest stories in ETFs right now and also look ahead to the future of ETFs. We're going to do all of that here in just a bit. Also joining me later will be Will Hershey, co-founder and CEO of Roundhill Investments. They also launched an ETF earlier this year, the Roundhill Bitcraft Esports and Digital Entertainment ETF, another great ticker symbol, NERD, N-E-R-D. And I've got to tell you, this entire video game and esports space is fascinating to me. If you haven't been following what's going on here, the growth and everything going on with both the social and competitive gaming aspect is mind-boggling. When you think about, you know, $3 million prizes for playing something like Fortnite. So I'm going to have Will paint the full picture for us and, of course, spotlight that ETF. Now, I'm going to start this week with ETF.com's Drew Voris. And on the topic of new ETF launches, we're going to look at several launches just over the past month or so. It was really a quiet summer in terms of new ETF launches, but if you look over about the past month, there have been nearly 40 new ETFs from both larger and smaller issuers. So I'm going to dive into several of these with Drew, and we'll also discuss which ones might find some success. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at ETFprime. Let's chat with ETF.com's Drew Voris.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, great having you back on the show. I feel like long overdue. It's been a while.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, guys. Hey, I just want to say I can't wait to hear Bob talk. He's always a great person to talk to about the industry, a walking encyclopedia. So great guest there, Nate Conn.
I'm really excited about that because we haven't had Bob on the podcast before. So, no, that should be a fantastic conversation. Okay, Drew, so we're going to look at some recent ETF launches. And I'm just going to jump around here, and you can give us your quick hot take. And I want to start with Charles Schwab, because they've been in the news a lot recently, right? They had the commission-free trading announcement. Last week, there was a report that they're going to allow purchases of fractional shares of stocks. But somewhat lost in the shuffle was they also launched three new ETFs on October 10th, three bond ETFs. And I thought this was noteworthy because they had only launched one ETF over the prior 6+ years. So I'm curious, what did you make of this? Any thoughts on that move?
Well, I mean, you kind of touched on all the nails. This is part of a major offensive from a major ETF issuer. Don't forget, Schwab is a $150 billion issuer, about $100 billion a year ago. So they've made some incredible strides, and this is just another salvo, if you will. They did launch three, and it was almost lost in the shuffle of their own news, right, Nate? Because of all these things happening with Schwab, about 10 days ago, they did launch three pretty basic vanilla ETF, bond ETFs for 6 basis points. Schwab 1-to-5-year corporate bond ETF SCHJ, and Schwab 5-to-10-year corporate bond ETF SCHI, and Schwab U.S. long-term U.S. Treasury ETF SCHQ. Nothing grand, innovative, just basic fixed income allocation bonds for 6 basis points, further along with their S&P 500 fund for 3 basis points. You can't get any cheaper than that. Free trade commissions, now potentially fractional shares. I mean, you're just seeing an offensive from what was sort of a mid-tier ETF issuer, now with $150 billion, certainly in the top 4 or 5. So they're going at it. And this is, again, I don't think it was, I think it's all part of a bigger plan that we've seen since the end of summer, just to get in people's mind that Schwab is, and maybe these are loss leaders, I don't know, but it certainly brings in a lot of attention, and we've seen the assets follow.
Drew, as it relates to Schwab's ETF launches, I've said before that I feel like they've been too conservative, and I get not just throwing stuff at the wall, but it seems like they've had an opportunity to expand their lineup for several years because they've had a lot of success with their products. But, you know, you look at their lineup, they only have 25 ETFs. They are the 5th largest ETF provider. But I guess my question is, you mentioned them kind of going on the offensive. Do you think they'll stay aggressive or get more aggressive with ETF launches moving forward?
Well, I think there's two trains of thoughts. Yeah, sure. But then you look at sort of the Vanguard model, too, where they are very judicious in what they launch. And if you look at the Schwab funds that are out there, 25 funds holding $150 billion, that's pretty good product suite in terms of holding up. And I can't think of the top of my head if Schwab's ever closed an ETF. But they launched basically 10 years ago with their first ETF. So I think this is just part of the game as they're going out there and just trying to offer investors the cheapest thing possible. No trade commissions, you know, basically free allocation to equity and bonds. And then everybody else has to just keep suit. And if you want to ignore Schwab, then you're ignoring $150 billion in assets in the ETF space.
Drew, with all of the major brokerages going commission-free now, as I look at the competitive landscape, Fidelity is really the only one who doesn't offer a core lineup of ETFs, right? Schwab does. We know Vanguard does. If you want to look at some of the other larger players, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, they all have or they will have a core suite of ETFs. And so now that the BlackRock deal with Fidelity appears unnecessary, right? They had this partnership where Fidelity was offering the iShares ETFs commission-free. But since all ETFs trade commission-free now, any reason why Fidelity wouldn't launch a core lineup of ETFs similar to what Schwab offers?
I think that makes sense. On the other hand, I also kind of look at how Schwab came along. They didn't just throw out everything they could out there. And Fidelity is a tenth of a Fidelity has $14 billion in ETF assets. So there are several steps behind Schwab sort of in the timeline, and that's going to come. And then they are also similar in the fact that they had to shift a lot of assets, you know, from their old mutual fund days into ETFs or attract new assets and put them into ETFs rather than mutual funds. And I think that's happening at Fidelity for sure. It's just whether or not you want to measure that by how many ETFs they have on the market or how it's going to build over the years. And the growth is sort of similar, of course, not in the aggregate, but, you know, they were around $11 billion a year ago. Now they have $14 billion. So it's a slow step up the ladder.
Okay, so the Schwab ETFs, I think we both agree, were they wouldn't have been under the radar. Two other launches I thought went completely under the radar, again, I think because of all the commission-free news, were these two ETNs from Barclays, the iPath Gold ETN, ticker GBUG, Goldbug, right? And then the iPath Silver ETN, SBUG. And what's noteworthy here is these are the first truly free ETPs. They're not using any fee waivers, and they both have zero expense ratios. Why do you think there wasn't more buzz here?
I think it's simply because it's an exchange-traded note. ETNs scare people, and maybe they should, because you're really buying in the counterpart. There's not a physical thing behind it. And they're really trading tools. And I think, you know, you're right. They did get lost. I think these launched the same day as Schwab launched their bond ETFs. So there's a lot of cheap going out there. And there's a point in time where even though it's a zero expense ratio, it is an ETN, and maybe people are a little cautious and saying, hey, wait, this is not quite the same thing as buying physical gold through an ETF, which you can, and you can get that for as cheap as 17 basis points with Granite Shares in their physical ETF, BAR, which I believe is the cheapest physically backed gold ETF. And I think people like to hold and know, and there's a big debate in the gold bug crowd whether or not, you know, there's gold actually in those vaults in London, and they are there. People like the idea of knowing it's there. And I really think Barclays has a special audience, special clientele for those kinds of products. They've been one of the leaders for years and years on ETNs. But I don't think it's really for the mass retail audience.
Well, and I think to your point as well, if you look at the mass retail audience and getting exposure to physical gold, the options that now exist there are pretty darn cost effective. I think we're now around 17 basis points on the lowest cost physical gold ETF. So, you know, looking at something like these ETNs, 17 basis points, that's 17 basis points, but that's not the end of the world, right? We're not talking about big dollars. Drew,
no, not at all.
Two other recent launches, actually at the beginning of October, both from innovator ETFs. They launched Define Outcome ETFs with exposure to the Russell 2000, that's ticker KOCT, and then the NASDAQ 100, NOCT. And of course, they've had a lot of success with their S&P 500 defined outcome ETFs. I think they also have products tied to both developed, international, and emerging markets. But overall, these things have been a huge success, right? Any thoughts on these two launches or just the innovator ETFs overall?
Well, what's interesting, it's not just one fund that comes out and attracts $1 billion. They have a handful, I think almost two dozen now, of these defined outcome ETFs that have over $2 billion in assets.
It's amazing.
And what it is it came out at the right time. These, I think the first came out 18 months ago, 2 years ago, right when the markets were getting choppy, and they're designed to cap your upside but also cap your downside. And that's something I think that's really resonating with advisors who can convey that to a client. Yes, you're holding the S&P 500, and if it goes up 20%, you may not see that, but if it goes down 20%, you may not see that either. And I can't get into the math as well as some of the ETF nerds out there can, but for some reason, and they, as you can see through their suite, it's almost like a ladder. They're timed, and they're going to go over not just the S&P 500. This is the first time they're making a move into other market indexes, and it's just basically capping upside, protecting downside, so it could conceivably work on any index. But I do know that they're focused more on domestic markets right now. I don't think they have any plans to take this, you know, overseas. They certainly may focus on emerging markets and others, but we'll see how this goes along. And, of course, you know, Nate, as well as anybody, when something succeeds, the copycats come along. And we've seen some more defined income ETFs come out. I think First Trust launched one, and I think you're going to see more come out. So once something works, you know, certainly iShares and State Street and Vanguard are looking at these things and thinking maybe we need to have those too.
One of the things that's amazing to me, and you were alluding to this, is that these products are more complex. And, you know, we've seen this move to more simple investment options, but that the fact that these are more complex hasn't stopped, you know, what, $2 billion from going into these. So I just think, pretty remarkable. And also, they're not the cheapest products in the world. So I think it really shows you these products are resonating with investors.
Well, it's not just the product. Obviously, Innovator's doing something that's helping convey, educate. And frankly, when they first came out, I was a little bit, I've never been very good at math. Other people saw this and went, yeah, that's a good idea. And like I said, market timing's everything, right? They're the first to launch these kind of products. They're in choppy markets. They resonated. They worked. And once things work, especially in the advisory community, it just begets more assets.
Okay, going down the list here again of some new ETFs that have launched over the past month or so, two other ones that jumped out at me, which listeners will not be surprised to hear me ask you about. Both of these actually launched in September. The U.S. Vegan Climate ETF, ticker VEGN, and the Global X Cannabis ETF, ticker POTX. Any traction on either of these yet? And I guess, what do you think of their chances moving forward?
Well, it all depends what the threshold of success is for the issuer. I know the Vegan ETF started out with some fanfare, which you would expect. I think it's got about $10 million in assets. It is traded. We'll see how it goes and how much. What can the issuer withstand? Does it take $100 million to keep the fund going? Obviously, it has some appeal. You start pulling back the layers, though. There's certain things. A lot of these, as we've known from thematic ETFs, a lot of these are just basically large and mid-caps and sometimes small caps. So there, in terms of the success, it has the great headline, has a great ticker. We'll see what happens there. In terms of PODX, it's kind of late to the party, pardon the pun. There's half a dozen, I guess, seven marijuana ETFs, a couple of them active. Only one has a significant amount of assets. Of course, that's MJ, the Alternative Harvest ETF, which started out as a different kind of ETF, but basically has $750 million in assets right now. At one time had $1 billion. That whole space has kind of been on a downtrend in terms of stock prices. And I think maybe you'll see two or three survive. But right now they're all, I call it kind of chasing candy under a pinata. They're all come to the party and they're all grabbing the candy. And right now MJ has most of it. Another fund from Advisor Shares, YOLO, YOLO, is actively managed. It has about $50 million in AUM. And beyond that, you start getting down to the other ones that have 20 or less million. And it's going to be really hard to, because it's a very niche kind of audience that's going to buy that particular fund. So I frankly would be surprised if we had more than three marijuana ETFs in the next 2 years.
I completely agree with that. I think we'll see a shakeout in that space. And perhaps if the regulatory environment changes moving forward, maybe that gives a little bit more of a tailwind behind, you know, one or two more of these ETFs. But as a whole, I agree with you. I think we're going to have some winnowing in this space. Drew, just a couple minutes left. I want to lump together a bunch of other recent launches here. So let me run through these. Overlay Shares launched five ETFs. These use a risk management overlay. There are these two HCM Defender ETFs that get in and out of the market. Granite Shares launched the XOUT U.S. Large Cap ETF, which we actually spotlighted a few weeks ago with Granite Shares founder Will Ryan. There's this new Merlin AI Bull Rider Bear Fighter ETF, which is under the Alpha Architect umbrella, that launched just last week. The question I have for you is, these smaller issuers clearly still seem comfortable launching new products despite all of the competition. So what do you think the recipe for success needs to be here? How do some of these really gain traction in this environment moving forward?
Well, of course, that's a $64,000 question. If I had that, you know, I'd have a line out my door. But without a doubt, the most innovation coming in the ETF space is from these small issuers. And some of those products you just mentioned are very innovative. They're very interesting products in the ETF world, in the ETF nerd world. How it sells on TD Ameritrade or on a no-commission platform, and do people get these things? So it really comes down to selling the advisory community on some of these, and I think that's why Innovator has done so well. They've been able to educate advisors, show them there's a consistent suite, and this is something that will work and starts working. So what they really need is success, and I hate to say this, but they need success and performance. because when something comes out of gate and it's very innovative, and timing helped Innovator, no doubt, with the way the markets work, but you really need to have success out the gate when you're a small issuer in terms of performance and just people getting the idea that you're trying to convey. That can sometimes be very complicated outside the ETF world.
No, completely agree, and I absolutely echo your thoughts on the innovation that's coming from smaller providers. There's no doubt that's the incubator of innovation within the industry. And I do think it's probably a little disheartening because you look at something like the Franklin Liberty U.S. Core Bond ETF, ticker FLCB, that launched on September 19th. That already has, I think, approaching $900 million in assets. Of course, that's a bring-your-own-asset strategy. So, you know, if you're these smaller providers and you see these larger providers that can just bring assets to the table on, you know, strategy like FLCB is pretty plain vanilla, probably not a whole lot of innovation. That's probably a little disheartening. But I agree with you. I think, you know, the path to success is getting the buy-in from the advisor community.
Hey, Nate, I just want to say one thing. I think it's very similar. I'm out here in Northern California, in Silicon Valley. The great innovation comes from small. We don't even see the startups come to IPO anymore like we did 20 years ago. So the Googles and the Facebooks and Amazon, they're buying up the innovation from the small startups that the public doesn't see. And I think that's sort of a wave we may start seeing. We saw it a year or two ago. We saw a wave of smaller issuers being bought up. We saw Global X, Index IQ bought by New York Life. We saw Lattice bought by Hartford Fund. So I think you're going to start seeing a lot more of that because it's easier to buy this innovation than create it or grow it. And I see that model in Silicon Valley, and I think you're going to start seeing it all over financial services.
Well, Drew, fun chat this week. Great having you back on the pod. Always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voris. All right, our next guest is Bob Toll, co-founder and president of ProcureAM, who launched their first ETF earlier this year, the Procure Space ETF, ticker UFO. Though Procure is simply the latest endeavor for Bob, who's a longtime ETF industry veteran. As I mentioned at the top, Bob has been involved with ETFs since the very beginning. He played a key role in launching the first country-specific ETFs, known as the World Equity Benchmark Series, WEBs. Those later became iShares ETFs. And that was just the beginning, because altogether, Bob has been involved in the design and development of over 400 ETFs across 19 countries. So that should give you a pretty good idea as to Bob's background. And Bob is now joining us via phone from New York. Bob, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm hoping that we can share some information with the audience that will help understand ETFs, both where they are and where they're going.
Well, yeah, and I want to focus more on the future of ETFs this week, but given your background, I think we have to spend at least a few minutes on the history of ETFs. I guess first, just looking back on your experience in launching the WEBs, and I know you even had some conversations with Nate Most prior to SPY, the first ETF launching. How surprised are you to see what ETFs have become today?
Well, I think the standard answer would people would say it's a surprise to them. I'm not as surprised as I should have been, perhaps, but I tend to look out further, and so I saw ETFs and the fact that, you know, we've been able to, through ETFs, reduce the fees that investors pay to gain exposure to the various equity markets, and that was something that I saw a long time ago.
And Bob, give us the quick story here. How did you first become involved with ETFs?
Well, I was at Morgan Stanley and experienced the 1987 stock market crash and saw a lot of retail investors get hurt, both going out of the market and coming into the market. And I really think that was the first time investors realized that when they were selling their mutual funds, they were selling them at the 4 p.m. closing price. And I got a mandate from our equity division to try to solve that problem. It took quite a while. And in those early days, it was when I met Nate Most. And I guess he was earnestly working on it in 91, and I went down a slightly different path because it was actually more profitable for Morgan Stanley and opened up a product in Europe and then came back and built the Webb's product with Nate. Matter of fact, Nate and I became great friends again, and I even put Nate on the board of the Webb's funds before I left Morgan Stanley and went to Deutsche Bank.
So, Bob, if we fast forward to today, you have a new endeavor, Procure AM, which saw its first ETF launch earlier this year, the Procure Space ETF. I'm curious, how did Procure AM come to fruition? And then maybe give us a quick update on how the Space ETF is doing so far.
Well, I had worked with Andrew Channon, and Andrew and I actually must have been on the same mindset because we called each other. And we decided we wanted to work together, and we then decided, okay, how can we do things slightly different within the ETF industry? It was getting crowded with products, et cetera. And Andrew had been known for theme investments, and so we looked it around and decided that space was one of the areas that was totally unexplored, shall we say, and we focused on building the first pure-play space ETF.
So looking ahead for Procure AM, what's next? Do you have some other ETF ideas in the hopper? Will you partner with other firms on ideas? What's the overall game plan?
Well, Procure is structured different than most ETF companies. We have our proprietary ETF passive platform. We have a partnership, which we refer to as the Procure Asset Launchpad for third-party products. And we also have an active ETF trust, which we haven't yet launched any products on. But we also have provided our clients with a Procure expertise for consulting services and Procure innovations, which is where we can license our intellectual property to third parties as well to help them get into the space.
Our guest is Bob Toll, longtime ETF industry veteran and co-founder and president of Procure AM. Okay, Bob, so what I thought we might do, just given your background, is I'm going to go around the horn on several of the biggest ETF stories this year, and you can just give me your quick take on each of these, and we'll see where this goes. And I think all of these are important to the future of ETFs as well. So let's start with some recent news, which is pretty much all of the major brokerages going to commission-free trading. And on top of that, I'll add in some big news from earlier this year, which is that we saw the first zero-fee and even negative-fee ETFs. From your perspective, as somebody who's been involved with ETFs since the beginning, and look, you know, theoretically, financial services and asset management are for profit, right? This isn't charity. So how do you view this fee compression across both financial services and asset management? What do you think the end game is here?
Well, it actually frightens me a little bit, to be honest with you. If people aren't making any money in the business that they're involved in, ultimately what happens is people leave the business and it's only left to the largest players, which unfortunately reduces competition and reduces really opportunities, I think, long-term for investors. And I think, quite frankly, the race to the bottom, if you will, it can only be afforded by people who have other revenue streams coming in from different areas. And whether they're like, and I'll just use Vanguard as an example, they have fees that they derive from the ETFs that are not strictly related to, you know, the processing of the trust, but providing other services.
So in terms of the end game here, I know Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas talks about how the ETF industry might end up resembling the airline industry, where there are a few dominant players, and then you'll have some niche or boutique players. Do you agree with that, or you see something different in the future?
Yes, and I think that's right to the point that I was referring to. When you have a fewer number of players in the marketplace, you really lose your options. And I think if you look at air travel, there may be cheaper prices, but I'm still convinced that the public isn't satisfied with the seating.
So, I mean, is there any way to turn this around? You know, how do we stay on a path where there's going to continue to be a lot of innovation in the ETF space? And, you know, it's not this grind to zero where it's tough for anybody to even stay in business unless you have just enormous scale. Is there a path forward?
I think there is. Obviously, Andrew and I believe that there is. And that is to stay out of, in essence, the pure beta space in the ETF market and focus on areas where you add value in returns that are different, and complete portfolio allocation models, or add an investment that is, in essence, more to the philosophy of the investor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those things really provide a different alternative to just getting pure beta exposure. You have smart beta that's come into the market. They've done very well because they've actually produced excess returns. And I think that's really one of the things that I've seen happen is that people are getting rid of ETFs that are giving better returns than this, the pure beta product, and they're doing it, if you will, for saving 10 basis points in fees, giving up 25 to 50 basis points in excess returns. And that, to me, is just foolish.
Bob, on the topic of maybe bringing products to market that aren't just pure data, I think everyone listening to this podcast already knows what I'm going to ask you next. But again, given your background, you've been involved in the development of some 400 plus ETFs. I have to get your take on this. Are you surprised a Bitcoin ETF hasn't been approved yet?
No, and I've had several discussions with this down in D.C. The bottom line is, unless the Bitcoin originators can solve what I consider a serious problem, which is there has to be a certainty of settlement and ownership, and I don't see that with the distributive ledger. I think there has to be some sort of depository function or some sort of public accounting firm involved directly in the blockchain that delivered the Bitcoin that basically can attest that they've seen this settlement and that it, in essence, is a true transaction.
The one thing that I have a hard time reconciling here, and I know there's two different government agencies that oversee these operations, but we do have a regulated Bitcoin futures market. And it just seems incongruent to me that we have that available to investors, but not a product that would hold those exact same futures and an exchange-traded product holding Bitcoin futures. I mean, does that seem incongruent to you?
Well, I'll tell you why I don't think the Bitcoin futures necessarily are a solution in that way, because you have the same problem as you do with a lot of futures. You have contango, which eats into the three-month roll activity that's involved in Bitcoin, would eventually just be a constant decay to investors.
Right, but we also have that in many other products as well that have been approved.
But those products have one thing that Bitcoin doesn't, which is the certainty of settlement.
Fair enough. You and I could probably go back and forth on this for an hour.
We could. I love futures, by the way. I was a commodity trader before I entered the equities world.
Bob, another big story this year, actually recently, and this probably helps level the playing field, if anything, going back to the discussion on perhaps the ETF industry looking like the airline industry. But we saw the approval of the so-called ETF rule. And obviously, you understand the regulatory landscape surrounding ETFs better than just about anyone. How impactful do you think that will end up being?
I think it's wonderful, quite frankly, that the ETF rules have been codified by the SEC and people have a clearer path to developing or launching the product. I also think it'll encourage new entrants who may not be in our domestic market, but perhaps from the international markets to come in. There's some of the rule changes that I saw that I didn't understand, but, you know, I think the market's going to have to help the SEC in that regard. And just for one, the use of the IIB not being mandatory going forward, and I think that was a reference point that investors used to judge the bid-offer spread.
Another approval we saw from the SEC was for these non-transparent ETFs, right? Persidion received approval for their active share structure. And look, I'm on record as saying I think this non-transparent structure faces some real challenges. I just don't know if it's something investors really want. Do you have any thoughts here? Do you think I'll be proven wrong?
Personally, I don't. And part of the reason I believe that it's a fine process, but it doesn't necessarily accomplish, in my opinion, what the large sort of non-ETF participants wanted in the marketplace. I think it is a solution, but I look at other alternative solutions that are available. In particular, I think AI is going to play a role in delivering to investors that which they are seeking, which is active ETF returns in excess of the benchmark index.
Bob, can you talk more about that? I know you're actually doing some really interesting work in this space, and I would agree. There's no doubt artificial intelligence is going to be a part of ETF's futures. Do you want to describe what you're working on here?
One of the things that I looked at, and one of the reasons I didn't necessarily fully pursue the non-disclosed active ETFs, is I kept looking ahead and saying, okay, what can we use? And there's a type of mathematics, a predictive mathematics called ensemble analytics that's been around for 40 years. It's been used by many people in the other industries associated with technology. And you look at that, and you look at what, if you will, investors have to digest anymore relative to the data that's in the marketplace and available and part of the decision-making, and you look at sort of machine learning, and it, to me, becomes obvious that AI, which is kind of all underneath, everything kind of fits underneath that umbrella, is really just another tool in the marketplace that I think investors will find much more advantageous, because the ability to predict returns based on information against high conviction stock picks or several other alternatives, that to me is something that adds value. It's we're producing portfolios through, not through Procure, but through another company called Pega Assets, where investors, the large institutional investors, have already done due diligence and are getting returns in excess of their benchmark index in a predictable basis. Our S&P 500 return is basically a 94% opportunity to beat the index by some 300 to 500 basis points.
Bob, do you view AI and ETFs as sort of smart beta 2.0? I feel like I've seen you say something along the lines of, you know, making beta even smarter.
Yeah, we've actually taken smart beta ETFs and run them through the same mathematical process, and have produced portfolios that are the smartest of the smart beta ETFs, if you will. And it's going to be in the marketplace. It's being currently reviewed by people.
All right, Bob. Lastly, before I let you go, I'd love to have you give us a bold prediction on ETFs, maybe something a bit wild, something that might surprise some people. And we won't hold you to this, but what might be going on in the world of ETFs 10, 15, 20 years from now?
Well, one of the things that I see is that through ETFs now, we have gotten to so many asset categories. I think you're going to see asset allocation models built around ETFs that include asset classes that are not typically part of a broker-dealer, if you will, asset allocation model. It's going to be beyond debt equities and international equities and international debt. It'll include the currencies. It'll include non-government-sponsored assets, such as a Bitcoin, or whether it's a private equity fund or a venture capital fund. You're going to see new forms, I think, of international debt where the governments will be issuing, if you will, debt-based ETFs, where the underlying performance is an equity index as opposed to something related to the debt market. And I think if you look at Japan, that's probably one of the first places it'll start, when you've got a zero interest rate environment and you can, in essence, as a government, equitize your equity holdings and put them out as a debt instrument. You now have a new way to, if you will, deal with things in a zero interest rate environment.
That's a really interesting point, because I'm sure you saw recently, I think it was Bank of America came out and basically proclaimed the death of the 60-40 portfolio, which I wouldn't go that far. But I think to your point, looking forward in the type of market environment we're in now and what it may be like going forward, might investors have to seek out additional sources of return outside of what they've traditionally done? I think that's an interesting point.
And that's one of the reasons why Andrew and I kind of focused on space. We're trying to look forward. I'll give you a really bold prediction. I think within the next 15 years, you're going to see government-sponsored 401k plans, if you will, in the Social Security system, versus those being put out by companies, because the companies' liabilities are far greater than their current pension plans. And I think eventually this is going to happen in the States. It's happened in Canada. It's happened in Australia. There's a couple of other large countries where the government has basically really turned over their Social Security program to the individual investor, and their component of that is a very small percentage.
Well, Bob, we're going to have to leave it there. Really enjoy the conversation this week. We're definitely going to have to do this again. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Happy to share.
That was Bob Toll, co-founder and president of Procure AM. All right, I'm now joined by Will Hershey, co-founder and CEO of Roundhill Investments. They launched an ETF earlier this year, the Roundhill Bitcraft Esports and Digital Entertainment ETF. I love the ticker symbol on this, NERD, N-E-R-D, and this obviously covers the esports and video game space. Will is on the line with us from New York. Will, great finally connecting. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be on.
So, Will, first, I don't think I've ever heard the backstory on this ETF. Where did the idea for Nerd come from? And I guess, are you a gamer yourself? Was this simply an investment idea, both?
Kind of both. So I guess what you would call in the gaming world, I'd say I'm a casual gamer. I'm a console gamer. A lot of the hardcore kind of competitive play nowadays takes place on PC. So that's definitely where I fall in the grand scheme of things. But really founded Round Hill with the goal of let's create ETFs that target this next generation of investor, where we're really looking at investment themes that younger people are passionate about, they believe in, we fall into that category. And our research kept leading us back again and again to gaming and esports, such an exciting segment.
Okay, so what I thought we might do is I'll first have you take us through the ETF itself, and then I really want to get into this business of video games and esports because I truly find it fascinating. I mean, we're now seeing 16, 17-year-olds winning millions of dollars playing video games, right? but first, explain how Nerd is built and what exactly it holds.
Sure. So I think when we look at thematic investing, which is ultimately what this is, our job as the index provider, as the ETF manager, is let's provide that exposure. And when you're talking about esports, it's always a little bit difficult to determine which companies are really exposed to this theme, right? I think I can think of one company off the top of my head that actually has a line item for esports. So how do we go about getting that exposure, getting our investors that beta? And really what we came to was a methodology that looks at screening public filings, 10-Ks, 8-Ks, presentations for keywords that we've determined are relevant to this theme. And you can imagine some of those keywords are esports, competitive video gaming, video game streaming. And when we put that screen in place, we really do two things. And at the end, it comes out into a score. And that score does two things for us. The first is it dictates which companies make it into the portfolio. So if you're getting a higher score, more mentions of those keywords, you're more likely to make it into the index. And then secondly, and this is where I think we're a little bit different, is we're not waiting on the basis of market cap. I mean, you can imagine an example. I'll use one that's not in there. You can imagine an example where Amazon, which owns Twitch, probably the largest streaming platform for games in the world, in a market cap weighted index, Amazon's, you know, 50% of the index. Really, what we say is let's once again get that beta by weighting on the basis of our scoring system. And really what we think that does is get you to a place where, you're not benchmark hugging, but instead this ETF is going to live or die in terms of how esports performs and whether it grows like we think it will.
So, Will, when you distill all that down, give us an idea as to some of the holdings that you end up with in the ETF. What does it end up looking like?
Sure. So from a category standpoint, they fall into a few main categories. The first is the game publishers. And I think unlike traditional sports where you or I could start a basketball league tomorrow, the game publishers at the end of the day really control the IP here. And, you know, we can't start the Overwatch League without Activision's buy-in. So they're kind of a core component there and probably one of the more obvious ones. Another example is really kind of these media plays. So a couple streaming platforms out of China, for example, Huya, which is really kind of the branded themselves as the Twitch of China. Another example is Modern Times Group on the media side, which runs esports events and tournaments and leagues. They're listed in Sweden, so it's kind of an under-the-radar name that's maybe difficult for people to get exposure to. And then the third category there is really gaming hardware. And I think a lot of people maybe understate this, but the same way that golfers need to go out and buy a new set of golf clubs to compete at a high level, gamers are doing the same thing. But instead of golf clubs, they're investing in mice, they're investing in keyboards, they're investing in gaming PCs. One example of an individual name there is Turtle Beach. I like to call Turtle Beach the Battle Royale stock, because if you think about it, Fortnite is kind of this Battle Royale concept where you have 100 people all dropping into a single map, competing against one another. And what we saw with Turtle Beach, which primarily their business is making gaming headsets, think about how much more important it is to have high quality sound when you're competing against 99 other people in a small map. So it was really interesting to see how that name performed kind of over the last year as Fortnite, PUBG, some of these battle royale games took the gaming industry by storm.
Will, you mentioned the game publishers. For people who maybe haven't been following this space as closely, what is the business model now for game publishers? You know, when I was younger, I think about shelling out, what, $40-$50 for a game, right? You owned it. Maybe you sold it back for some cash down the road. What's the model now?
No, that's a great question. And you're exactly right. That's what it used to be. You know, you have a physical copy of your game, whether it was a cartridge or later on a disc. And really, the game that was, you know, in the software as it existed on that cartridge was it. That was the software. And once you played it through, that was it. What we've seen now is a shift towards what we would call kind of a games as a service model. And what I mean by that is you kind of have two versions in terms of how this is playing out. And the first one is kind of a free-to-play model, one that we've seen by game, you know, put out by games like Fortnite, like League of Legends, where, like I said, the content initially is free, and then they're monetizing based on in-game transactions, whether that's buying, you know, a skin, as you would call it, so a costume for your character to wear, or something that might help you actually even in-game. We call that kind of pay-to-win. But really what that's done is allowed for titles to really have longevity. And it's been driven by technology, if you think about it. The fact that publishers now can put the initial game out and then iterate it via patches over the internet is something we couldn't have seen, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And then kind of the second model that we're seeing is a little bit more like what we were used to in the past, but it's kind of this annual release model. And we've seen that implemented by games like Call of Duty, like FIFA, where, you know, you're going to buy the new Madden to get the rookies every single year. It'll be interesting to see whether they shift to kind of moving away from the physical hardware of the game itself and start doing that via patches the same way that kind of these free-to-play games are. But really what this has done is, like I said, increase the longevity of games that are really popular. For example, Counter-Strike's been around 10, 20 years, StarCraft 10, 20 years. We're seeing now that the games that are really popular, driven by the community, can be monetized and iterated time and time again.
Well, and it also looks like even advertising and sponsorship deals, right? You had a tweet yesterday, which was just mind-boggling to me. I think it was NBA 2K, where there's a partnership with Nike, where you have these custom shoes in the game, and then you can actually purchase those shoes, I believe, like in real life. It's just crazy.
It is crazy, and I think one thing people need to appreciate here is that in gaming, unlike other forms of entertainment, you really have this interactivity between real and virtual, and kind of a reverse example of that was in Fortnite, they had a Samsung Galaxy skin. So your character would wear this cool Samsung designed skin, but in order to get the skin, you had to purchase the new Samsung phone. So it can kind of go both ways there in terms of how they work with brands and sponsors to kind of connect with this audience. And it's an audience that's really in demand for advertisers, right? You're talking about an audience that skews more towards Gen Z, that skews more towards digital consumption and digital natives. And it's really interesting to see how large brands throughout the world are getting involved, whether it's on the esports side or in-game, like we're talking about.
So, Will, on that note, let's get to the overall investment case for video games and esports. And honestly, I'm not even sure where to begin. There are just so many interesting aspects here. I mean, if you think about it, last week, I know you saw this, there were millions of people literally staring at a screen with a black hole on it, waiting for the next chapter of Fortnite to be released. And not only that, there were a bunch of people watching a live stream of those people watching the black hole. I mean, it's just crazy. But let's maybe start with something like Fortnite, because I do think it's a great example in terms of just the social element to video gaming now. Even compared, you know, I think about when I fired up my Atari or Nintendo back in the day, right? It was just maybe me and a couple of friends in the house. But now there's this huge social component to something like Fortnite. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, and just kind of to make sure that everyone's aware of what you were talking about. So Fortnite just released Chapter 2, if you will, of their game. And in order to do that, they redesigned their entire map. And typically what we've seen, and this is just so brilliant in terms of marketing, typically what we've seen is a game developer will say from, you know, this time to this time overnight, probably on the East Coast, we're going to shut down the game and update the map, and then it'll be ready to go when everyone wakes up in the morning. What Fortnite did was say, we know that we're going to have to shut down the servers in order to make this big change and in order to implement it. And what they did was make a marketing stunt out of it, where it's almost the equivalent of like the off season for a traditional sport. They took the off season and made it something that people cared about. And I think it just was incredible to see how they were able to be so creative and captivate. Like you said, 6 million plus concurrent people were watching. Forget about the people in game. We're watching other people stare at their screen, wondering what was going to happen next. And that took place for, you know, 2 days. But it really, to your point, highlights Fortnite and a lot of these games as really social platforms. And when I kind of look at what they've become, for me, when I would go home after school, I would log on to, and you could probably age me here, but I would log on to AOL Instant Messenger. And that's how I would communicate with my friends. And what you're seeing now is games, and Fortnite in particular has done this really well. Games have become the platform for people to communicate and to get together and to have fun. And I think what we've seen in that game is it's become less about winning and more about hanging out with your friends, right? You always have a headset on. You're always talking. You're always having fun. And that's really where you can see how kind of the total addressable market starts to move over into taking share away from social media. And it really gets exciting in terms of kind of the engagement numbers we're talking about and how big this industry can become.
Will, does this also explain the video game streaming? You mentioned something like Twitch. Is that part of the social component? Because if you talk to, baby boomers, they'll say, I can't believe my kid is watching other kids play video games. Like, I completely failed at parenting. So what is the attraction of streaming?
Yeah, no, that's 100% part of the social component. And I think when you look at gaming, unlike other forms of entertainment like music or TV or film, no one wants to watch someone else listen to, music with their headphones in. People want to watch other people game, to your point. And I think the reason for it, there are a couple. I think the first is people want to see people who are experts, who are incredible at something. The same reason why we have attractions to traditional sports that we might not play on our own, or maybe we do. The second reason is more kind of, people want to learn how to get better. They want to learn tips and tricks and see what are they missing, what are they doing wrong in their own game. And then I think the third reason really is a lot of these streaming personalities are just that. They're personalities. They're exciting people. You want to watch them. You want to be engaged. You want them to, and this is an interesting fact, that a lot of people are actually donating to streamers in order to get them to kind of read their Twitch handle on stream. And that's kind of the equivalent of, I don't know, taking a selfie with LeBron after the game. You're kind of 10 seconds of fame. But all of this kind of relates to the fact that gaming is making its way into mainstream culture, and a lot of younger people want to engage with that, whether it's as a viewer only or as a gamer and a viewer.
So Will, I think you're getting down this path where, obviously all of this is translating over into a competitive arena, right? It's not just social. It's now morphed into professional competition. How did that happen? Was there some sort of pivot point or catalyst, or do you think that was just the natural next step in the evolution here?
Yeah, so esports, competitive gaming, has been around for a while. It's been around for, call it 20 years or so. Electronic Sports League, ESL, was founded in 1997. That's a subsidiary of one of our portfolio companies, but really it's been taking place outside of the U.S. It's grassroots, kind of started in Korea with StarCraft. China has a huge esports scene. The EU, and I think it's very interesting, and this actually bears it out in terms of our portfolio, which is only about, call it 20-25% U.S. A lot of it's non-U.S. We're really just now kind of catching up to the rest of the world in terms of this concept as a form of mainstream media. But I think what you've seen, and once again, I keep coming back to Fortnite because I think it was just that important from a social phenomenon standpoint. Gaming became cool, right? You had Ninja, who's probably the most famous professional gamer, streaming with Drake, right? And you had crossover between athletes and musicians starting to show that they love gaming and they want to play Fortnite with the top gamers. And I think once that kind of happened, and this is all over the past couple of years here, gaming became cool and it became something that people wanted to watch and compete in. And we saw $4.5 billion invested last year privately into the space. You have, you know, Bob Kraft buying into an Overwatch team, Jeff Wilpon, owner of the Mets, buying into an Overwatch team. These guys really see that the demographics, the eyeballs, when you're talking about younger generations, you know, MLB's viewership is declining every year. Where are those younger eyeballs going? They're going towards esports and gaming. And when we look at esports in particular, the competitive side of things, you're talking about 400 million people globally that are watching right now. And I think that once again highlights the fact that it is very much a global phenomenon. That's going to grow to 600 million by 2022. There's a ton of excitement and people that want to watch. The longer term question will be how well can we figure out monetization?
You know, I think the big aha moment for everybody was, of course, over the summer. We all saw the 16-year-old win $3 million playing Fortnite. That was on NBC Nightly News, right? It was in USA Today. And I think for many people, the reaction was, what? You can make millions of dollars playing video games? You know, how is that possible? But I think you're getting to why that's happening, just because of the number of eyeballs. And this is a global phenomenon. You know, I'm curious. Obviously, you're a little bit biased, which is okay, but what's the case for esports over other professional sports leagues? I'll let you decide which other sports you want to compare it to, but just to kind of maybe give us some perspective, why might esports have more upside than some other professional sports leagues?
Sure. I mean, I think probably when I look at which traditional sports I think are going to do really well over the long term, I look to soccer or football, whatever you want to call it, and basketball. And the reason that I like those traditional sports are because they're very much so global. You know, it's really easy to get a group of guys together and play soccer. If there's a hoop, it's really easy to play basketball. Not so much for football or hockey. And there are other reasons that I think, you know, those sports are potentially at risk. Same for baseball for a different reason. But really what it comes back to is how easy is it for people to get engaged and to play? Because I think that if you're going to be a viewer of a sport or an esport, it starts with playing first. And what we're seeing with esports is you're talking about 2.5 billion gamers globally right now. And that's going to continue to grow. And I think the reason that I'm so excited about how it can grow is really driven by technology and hardware. Nowadays, you can play PUBG or Fortnite or Call of Duty on your smartphone. And I don't even mean you need to have the newest, you know, iPhone 11. You can play those games, those AAA games now on your smartphone with, call it an iPhone 6S, for example. What that's really done is expanded the player base to countries like India, like parts of Latin America, where, you know, a gaming console that costs $500 or a gaming PC that costs $2,000 really kind of limited who is able to play. And what we're seeing now is smartphones have democratized people's ability to play, and it's only going to continue to grow and make it a global phenomenon.
And the technology is amazing. I mean, I have two younger daughters, and they both recently downloaded the new Mario Kart. And I was looking at it, and I'm like, this thing looks better than, you know, what I had as a kid on a console, right? And they downloaded it for free in 2 seconds.
No, that's absolutely right. And what we're starting to see more and more, you mentioned Mario Kart, great example, which I think is the second best mobile launch ever. Call of Duty surpassed it about a couple months after, just recently. What we're seeing now is publishers are taking that IP that was historically reserved for console because of kind of the hardware needs and porting it over to mobile. And I think what we're going to continue to see is more and more what you'd call cross-console. So part of the reason Fortnite was so successful was you could be playing on your phone while I was playing on my Xbox and our other friend was on our team playing on his PC. that's going to become something that's really important for maintaining the social concept where we don't all need to be, you know, have a PC to play together. And that's going to be something that becomes standard for these publishers going forward.
Will, we just have a couple of minutes left. I have one last serious question for you, and then I have a few fun ones to close with, which I think you'll enjoy. But going back to the ETF, for financial advisors out there, and I've talked about this before on this podcast, actually, I feel like there's a decent chunk who are ignoring what's going on in this space. And I think the reason is they don't want their clients opening up an account statement and seeing a video game ETF on there, right? They think maybe it's not sophisticated enough. It's not some Goldman Sachs quant fund. Do you think that's a real issue, or am I making that up?
I think maybe half and half. I think that for some, that's definitely a real issue. For us, that comes down to education. And I think when you look at gaming as a whole, you're talking about a $150 billion industry growing 10% per year. That's larger for reference than the music industries and box office combined. I think once you start putting these figures in front of people, they can't ignore it. And you're really talking about an industry that's very much so global, right? I think part of it also is a lot of the names that are exposed to the space aren't household names. You know, only 20% or so of our index is U.S. I think that might be part of it as well. But as the Fortnite World Cup happens, like you said, and you have a teenager winning $3 million, I think there's only so much time people can kind of go ahead and ignore it till it's too late.
All right, let's close with a few fun rapid-fire questions. We'll go quick here. Give me your favorite video game right now.
Right now, I'd say Apex Legends. That's Electronic Arts.
All right, your favorite upcoming new release. So which new game coming out has you most excited?
Okay, so coming up, I would say Cyberpunk 2077. And for people that don't know, that game's been 6 or 7 years in the making. It is from CD Projekt out of Poland developer.
All right. What's your favorite video game of all time?
That's
a tough one.
What's yours? I would say Halo, the original. You can't go wrong.
Okay. So would Xbox, the original Xbox, be your favorite console of all time, or do you have a different console?
No, I think I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
All right, last question. So I have never played a single game of Fortnite. I have seen it, so I know what it's about. How long do you think I would last in that game if, you know, I like just drop down on the island or whatever? Like, how long would I make it?
Okay, so this is actually more interesting than what you probably thought. So if it was chapter one, I would say I'd give you, I don't know, a minute? But what they've done in Chapter 2, and this is how brilliant these game developers are, is they've added bots. They've added AI-based bots to the game so that when it's your first time dropping in or your second time dropping in, they want you to feel like you're pretty good, like you're winning. And they've done that to increase engagement and get people who, you know, like you said, if you're going in the first time right now, people have been playing this for 2 years. They're going to kick your butt. But what they've done is really make it so that you feel good about yourself. Maybe you even get a win on the first time and coming back and again and again. That's how smart these game developers are from understanding the mindset of people playing their game, right? It's really down to a science.
All right, I'm going to give you one bonus question as well. How long would you last in a game of Fortnite with professional Fortnite players?
With professional?
Professional.
5 seconds. Literally 5 seconds. That is not an exaggeration.
It's amazing. Will, fun stuff this week. Congratulations on the ETF. Certainly wish you all the success. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Nate. Take care.
That was Will Hershey, co-founder and CEO of Roundhill Investments. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, it's going to be all Bitcoin and Bitcoin ETFs. We'll be joined by both Gabor Gerbax, Director of Digital Asset Strategy at VanEck, and Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise Asset Management. We are going to go in-depth on the SEC's position on Bitcoin ETFs, what might happen next, and we'll also discuss the crypto markets in general. Until then, have a great week, everyone.